You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last week, much of the United States experienced a blast of frigid cold and snow that grounded flights, left motorists in Atlanta stranded in their cars, and caused record low daily temperatures from Michigan to Texas. It's prompted some people to claim that it proves global warming is not happening. Yet, it's important to bear in mind, according to Chris Mooney, a science journalist for Climate Desk and a Mother Jones contributor, that just because you're freezing, it doesn't mean that what you're experiencing is an accurate reflection of what's happening to the planet overall, or even to the United States. His article that explains why you might be cold right now, but your planet isn't, is in this month's Mother Jones, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Chris Mooney to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
You've called the notion that this cold spell is proof that global warming is not happening weather-induced cluelessness.
Yeah, that's about right. We hear it every year when it's cold out. You know, as you know, there's lots of people who don't believe in global warming, and boy, they come out and they use the weather as an anecdote to argue against statistics and science, and it's a very, very, very bad argument. But there's many reasons why. One of them is just that, you know, at any time when half the planet's in winter, the other half of the planet is in summer. This is how it works, right? And so, you know, you can't say anything globally by just observing cold weather where you are.
Last week, when Atlanta, Georgia experienced 3 inches of snow, its residents were shocked. But wasn't snow in places like Atlanta much more common in the past than most people remember? Atlanta recorded 9 inches in a single day on January 19th, 1893. So has our climate changed so much that what was once normal now seems shocking?
I'm not sure. You just educated me about Atlanta's past snow history. I mean, I think I would put it like this. The whole idea that global warming is going to make there be less snow, it'll mean there's less snow that stays on the ground, that's for sure. But in some ways, global warming, we know, increases overall precipitation. So there's many reasons to expect that when you have the right conditions for snow, and winter isn't going to go away, that you could actually get more snow. With Atlanta, you know, I think that it's important to understand that particular event in the context of all of the other striking events that have been happening. You know, the drought in California, extreme heat in Alaska. They're like, where's winter up there? They're very confused. You know, extreme rain in the United Kingdom, and then the cold in the U.S. Northeast. What's happened is this very, very odd pattern of the jet stream.
Now, why has the Arctic vortex dipped so far south? Is it because it has been warming up further north?
There's this thing going on, and climate scientists are fascinated. They don't fully understand it, but there's a pattern that they call warm Arctic, cold continents, and they keep seeing it pop up. And the reason that they think it might be happening is that we know that the Arctic is warming at a rate faster than the mid-latitudes of the planet. And in fact, you know, the National Academy of Sciences just had this report on extreme climate change, or, you know, basically catastrophic climate change, these kind of events that Hollywood makes movies out of, and they say, have any of them happened yet? And they said, well, there's one extreme that's happening right now. It's the Arctic's warming so fast that you really ought to call it an abrupt climate change. And so that is going to have global impacts on weather. I mean, if you have that big of a change to that important of a part of the world, then it's going to be felt. And so now they're trying to tease out how it's felt. And one increasingly prominent idea is that it's interfering with the jet stream and making the jet stream loopy. One of the metaphors we used that people liked, a lot of people used, was the jet stream is drunk. You know, it's staggering around aimlessly, doesn't know what it's doing anymore. And that can, you know, change the weather and make weather extreme for longer periods of time.
And you said that the same things that are causing this cold can be linked to the drought that you people in California are going through?
Right, because the jet stream, what happened is that when you get this kind of jet stream, basically it's elongated. It usually runs relatively straight from the west to the east, and it serves as the boundary between cold weather to the north, you know, warmer weather to the south. Instead, it's done this big loop, so it looks like a big wave. And on one side, you get one kind of weather, and on the other side, you get another kind of weather. So, things are all connected.
Well, you're right. Go ahead.
No, they're all connected. And so that's sort of the big picture that climate scientists are paying attention to. Meanwhile, people anecdotally in one place might say, oh, it's cold, I don't believe this. But look at the big picture and you see something very strange with the jet stream.
Well, you're right that California has a rainy season, which should be happening right now. And it goes into March?
They're finally going to get some rain. Right. They're finally going to get some rain, it looks like. And that is a very, very big deal because some estimates say that this is the worst drought in 500 years. And I read this weather blogger and writer who's really amazing named Jeff Masters of Weather Underground, and he actually estimated today that just this rain might be worth $1 billion. They need it so badly.
Because California depends so much on agriculture, but also it can have other impacts. Electricity rates.
Right. If they don't have enough water, then they're not going to be able to use as much hydropower. And so they're going to have to use dirtier energy. So there's this irony that even as global warming is going to produce an increased risk of drought conditions for the Southwest, and that includes California, if you're in drought conditions, you might have to use more carbon-intensive energy. There are many, many of these sorts of ironies and feedbacks in climate change. I mean, it's the biggest scary thing is that if the drought doesn't end, and you know they need a lot more rain than what they're forecast to get for it to end, then you have to really start to worry about the kind of fire season that they're going to have.
Isn't the Sierra Nevada snowpack now just 10 to 30% of its normal levels? Is that going to affect
low.
The state's water supply as well?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the chief sources of feeding into their water supply. And, you know, there's a stunning image, I think it was put out by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, just showing the Sierra Nevadas at the same time in January of 2013 and January 2014. And it's just so shocking because one picture has snow and the other, it just, you don't see almost any. And it's frightening. And I know that the most frightening thing is that this is the pattern that's expected in the future.
Well, you talked about the rain that's coming to California, but is there going to be enough rain to forestall all the problems? How much rain would be enough, considering the fact that we are talking about some areas of the state recording the driest seasons on record? And that, of course, has exacerbated the wildfire situation.
Sure. They need a lot more than they're currently forecast to get. They need it to happen while the rainy season still goes on. And again, my expert that I rely on for some of this stuff is Jeff Masters of Weather Underground. He actually said they need 6 more big rains like the one they're supposed to get before they're going to for drought to end. I don't think anyone thinks that the drought's necessarily going to end before the end of the rainy season. It would be really nice for them if it did.
Well, of course, since the weather is so unpredictable, the rainy season may come after March instead of end at March.
Possibly, yeah. It's a whole new world. And I want to emphasize, you know, this theory about the changing of the jet stream, it's really interesting science. It's new science. It's not fully proved. What I think climate scientists agree about is that if you change the Arctic this much, you bet it's going to affect the weather. Exactly how, pinning it down. But the jet stream theory, you know, has growing force behind it, in part because we keep seeing these kinds of extremes that fit the theory.
Are we seeing the same thing in the southern hemisphere with the Antarctic?
Well, the Antarctic is in a different kind of situation. I mean, the Antarctic and the Arctic are very different because the Arctic is a lot of sea ice, the Antarctic it's a lot of land ice. I don't think that we're seeing exactly the same situation down there. I mean, we have seen some really scary extremes there. Australia has had just heat and fires that are terrifying. I mean, you know, we're there trying to play tennis down there, and people were, you know, not able to almost do it. It was so hot.
And then penguins are dying off, and at the same time, ships are being locked in the ice near Antarctica.
Right, but that got a lot of play. I mean, you know, exactly what's going on with the ice of Antarctica is a very interesting and fascinating scientific topic. I don't know all of the details of that. With the penguins, I just read this headline. It looks like, I mean, everywhere, and this is one of the things that climate change predicts, is more extremes. And it looked like there was a scientific study saying that this might be having a direct effect on baby penguins because I guess they're very sensitive to a lot of rain or a lot of heat in the way that the parents aren't. And so that was sort of a shocking and sad story.
My guest is Chris Mooney, who is a science journalist for Climate Desk and also writes for Mother Jones. And his article in Mother Jones is You Might Be Cold Right Now, But Your Planet Isn't. Let's get to how these records are kept. What's the difference between a daily record and an all-time record?
Yeah, we have great tracking of weather data by the National Climatic Data Center, and they, you know, they have records going back, in some cases, over 100 years. And so they look at, in a particular place where they've got a weather station, what's the highest and lowest temperature that's ever been recorded in this place, ever, in any of these years, and also what's the highest and lowest that's been recorded in any month, and then on any day. And so they can tell you, so records are breaking all the time for a particular day. So it'll be the hottest we ever had on January the 2nd in this place. An all-time record is much harder to break. But what happened in January, and January in the United States was cold, there's no denying it, and more all-time cold records, but especially more daily cold records.
1,600 of them, in fact, in January alone.
Those numbers are constantly being added to, but I believe that it was something like that many. There were many more of these daily cold records than daily hot records, so that's one way of saying this was a surprisingly cold period of time, and a lot of records were broken, and the records were skewed in the cold direction. And so, you know, you might say, oh, there's your proof against global warming, but not really. I mean, it takes a lot more than a month for us to understand a trend. And if you look at the trends, it turns out that overall, hot records have been greatly outnumbering cold records for the past couple of decades. And that's what you would expect in a warming climate. One, you might say that that's the very definition of climate change, is that if you're going to break a weather record, it's more likely to be a hot record than a cold record if there's a trend in the hot direction. And so climate scientists have done the statistics on all this, and that's what they conclude. And then they crunch the data on the records, and they found, for instance, for the 2000s, they found a 2-to-1 ratio of record highs to record lows.
A congressman from San Diego suggested some years ago that if climate change is true, he says it isn't, but if it is true, then the people in Boston might appreciate it because they'd have warmer winters. But I was thinking, well, what's going to happen in San Diego? But are scientists suggesting that places that are now temperate zone are going to become more tropical?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a shift. You know, some people have said, oh, basically, you know, you're going to move New Hampshire down to North Carolina or something like that, in effect, for the kind of climate you're going to get.
But the skiers will appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, the ski industry is one of the industries that's suffering the most, of course, from climate change, because they've lost the predictability of the seasons. They've lost a lot of snow cover. They're being really, really hard hit. But this story that we're hearing now about the warm Arctic cold continents sort of complicates this idea that we just, you know, every state in effect shifts south and gets the weather of the states that the states south of it used to get, for instance. I'm not sure that it's necessarily that simple if the Arctic warming starts to, in effect, change the jet stream and displace a lot of cold southward. So I think that this is still remains to be seen. I mean, no one would say that we had a particularly light winter. But if the jet stream was to set up in a different place, we might have a light winter and a different year. But the main thing that the theory predicts is that you will have more of one extreme that will stay for longer and stay in place for longer. And it could be hot, it could be cold, it could be wet, but it's going to stick around.
Well, is this working in conjunction with El Niño?
El Niño is a really fascinating part of the equation. One of the last major El Niño that we had was 1998, and it turns out that if you look at the temperature records that are kept by NASA and NOAA, all of the top 10 years, 10 hottest years, have been since 2000 except 1998. 1998 is the one that's still up there among the top years, and that's because it was just so hot, because El Niño is this phenomenon in the Pacific that affects global weather, and when you get a really strong one, then you get hot weather across the globe. So everyone's saying, just wait for the next El Niño, and then you will see a global temperature that will shatter all of the records, because we've been getting close, you know, without El Niño. So that's coming, and all kinds of things happen during El Niño, including a lot of intense hurricanes in the Pacific. So and we don't know whether El Nino is going to show up this year. But it will come back eventually, and it will be hot.
Of the daily low temperature records set during last month, where did most of them take place?
Oh, gosh, I'd have to go and look. I think a lot of them were in the, obviously, where you expect them to be, the Northeast, around Chicago, around Michigan, all those sorts of places. All the places where the polar vortex descended, you know, they were setting a lot of new. And these are daily records. In terms of all-time records, there was not as many all-time records as you might have expected because we have shifted towards a warmer climate overall.
And people in Atlanta are not prepared in the way people in the North are. They were tied up with 2 inches of snow. 2 inches of snow in New York is barely a snowfall.
But right. We might get it this weekend. You know, it's not a big thing to us right there in D.C. We're pretty used to that. That was a snafu. And based on my reading, it looks like the weather forecasters did a pretty good job of saying what was going to happen, and this really becomes a policy matter.
Chris,
go ahead. No, in terms of how you manage large numbers of people.
Chris Mooney's article, "You Might Be Cold Right Now, But Your Planet Isn't," is in the current issue of Mother Jones. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Chris Mooney, whose article, "You Might Be Cold Right Now, But Your Planet Isn't," is in the current issue of Mother Jones. Last Tuesday, NASA and the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration released their climate data for 2013. Didn't they come to slightly different results?
Yeah, they have different ways. I was talking to a person at NASA who heads this. They have slightly different ways of estimating the warming of the Arctic because there aren't a lot of stations up there. So what happened was that NASA said that last year, 2013, was tied for seventh hottest ever, and NOAA said it was tied for fourth hottest ever. But again, almost all of the top 10 minus 1988, are since the year 2000, and this is a great indicator that, of course, we are warming and warming and warming. I don't think the little difference between NASA and NOAA is a big problem because they just have slightly different methodologies. The trend is very clear. It's up and up and up.
You said earlier that the data shows that the rate of warming over the 2000s wasn't quite as rapid as what we experienced in the 1990s. How do we account for that?
That is the big issue of the so-called, and I put it in quotes, global warming pause. And this was made so much hay of last year. And basically, there's somewhat of a slower rate of warming in the 2000s than, for instance, in the 90s. On the other hand, you know, the 2000s are clearly a hotter decade overall than the 90s. So I don't think you should make too much out of this because that's what global warming predicts. I think that scientists are trying to figure out the exact reasons, and one of the best explanations that they have is that heat has been going down into the deep ocean, and so that's one of the main sources of heat on the planet is, of course, the ocean. And if it ends up deeper, then you can have slightly colder temperatures at the surface. But the long-term trend is ultimately going to be up, and I don't think anybody who's watching the science discounts that. There was also some real misinformation about this because a lot of the people who were claiming, and you would hear things like, it hasn't warmed in 16 years, what they were doing was they were playing a sort of statistical little game where you picked 1998. We talked before about how that was such a hot year, and then you looked at the trend by just seizing on 1 year, and you're not seeing as much if you choose your starting points in a particular way to get that kind of answer. But if you look at the broader context, we're definitely warming, maybe not quite as fast in the 2000s as the 90s, but we're going up, and I think the climate scientists don't expect that to change.
And pretty much every climate scientist agrees that we're going through a change. And yet in this country, as you point out, a new study done by Yale and George Mason University found out that the number of Americans who don't believe in climate change is actually going up, unlike people in the rest of the world. Why do you think it's happening in this country?
This is an oddity. The United States needs to be explained. And one of the things might well be this thing about the global warming pause. It was used very successfully to sow doubt in an unwarranted way about the conclusions of climate science.
By whom?
Mainly By the political right. I mean, this.
And
was,
why do you think the political right is involved in climate change denial when pretty much everyone else thinks that climate change is an obvious occurrence?
Well, I think it's become basically a kind of almost culture war type of issue. The motivation has been written about and studied a lot, and basically it is a particular kind of economic / libertarian ideology that believes in free markets and has come to perceive the idea of climate science itself as an affront to this free market philosophy. And I don't know why it had to be that way. I mean, it seems to me like you could have thought markets are a good thing without thinking, you know, you have to deny what's obvious about what humans are doing to the planet. But nevertheless, that has been the case. And so they believe that the science is concocted in order to support a left-wing command and control government takeover of the economy. And so therefore, the science gets discounted because it's a threat to the ideology.
That's, they could also see this as a business opportunity.
Right. And you could make that case. And, you know, certainly there are a lot of people in renewable energy who are making that case all the time and who are putting their money down to support their belief that that is where the opportunity is. But nonetheless, that is how it has played out. And we are in a highly polarized condition with this issue. I mean, if you want to predict what someone thinks about global warming, just ask if they're a Democrat or Republican. It's a very, very good predictor.
I'm talking with Chris Mooney, who's a science journalist for Climate Desk, also contributed to Mother Jones, where his article, "You Might Be Cold Right Now, But Your Planet Isn't," is in the current issue. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Ludit Lopate. Well, on Wednesday, the Obama administration announced the creation of 7 regional climate hubs to help farmers and rural communities respond to the risks of climate change, including drought, invasive pests, fires, floods. Do you think these climate hubs will have any impact on educating and helping people deal with climate change?
I certainly hope so. I think that this is part of the administration. I mean, this is just a kind of information clearinghouse, and it's something that the administration can do by executive action because Congress is not about to do anything. And that's been the whole Obama policy on climate change since the middle of last year, is that we're just going to bypass Congress because obviously we don't expect any change in Congress, so we're going to do everything we can without them.
And there have been howls as a result of that,
right,
people complaining.
Yeah. Nothing was happening. And so at some point, President Obama said, you know what, enough. And so this is part of a suite of adaptation initiatives that are part of the new policy of the administration. And it's really, really important because there's so many things about climate change where you're never going to unring the bell. I mean, it's set in motion. There's going to be all sorts of change, and there's no way of avoiding it. One of the most dramatic, not affecting farmers so much necessarily, but affecting a lot of people's livelihoods, the sea level rise, that's just going to be a steady climb. We hope it's always steady. We hope it's never more than steady. We hope it's never dramatic, but that will depend on the big ice sheets of the planet. But for the foreseeable future, it's just going to be steady up and up and up, and our coastlines are going to get slowly eaten up. And there are going to be huge economic implications of that. So you got to ready yourself. You got to ready yourself for that, for droughts, for more extreme weather in some places, for all kinds of things that we can't stop. And so I think it's responsible and necessary to try to help people do this.
Well, do you think that people in rural communities in Republican voting districts are going to be caught in a bind here? They tend to have a negative view of the EPA, which regulates agricultural activities like the use of pesticides and water on farms. At the same time, they might find the information available from these climate hubs valuable.
I think it's really important how this information is presented. There's a lot of research on adaptation issues in locales that are not necessarily, you know, left wing in the Northeast or something like that. And it turns out that if people are told about the issue the wrong way, they will sort of turn off. But at the same time, if everyone's told that it's important to be ready, that you've seen yourself that the world around you is changing, a lot of people viscerally feel that that is the case. And then you can depolarize it to some extent. We're going to have a lot of these interesting sort of experiments where ideology and the practical come into conflict in particular locations because of climate change. And so I think it's important to not try to push political buttons when you're trying to help people adapt. And I certainly hope that's what's going to be going on. I have every reason to think that it will be, because that's the only way to do it. If you polarize people, then yeah, your adaptation initiatives are going to end up getting sucked into the culture war over climate change.
Well, isn't there a certain amount of polarization already at work? Nebraska is currently suing the administration over a draft climate change regulation that was issued in September, which would cut carbon pollution from future coal-fired power plants.
Oh, no, there is. There is, and I wouldn't want to downplay it. But at the same time, I think that if you go across the country and you talk to farmers, you know, Climate Desk, we've done stories about this, everybody kind of knows in the back of their head that this is not my grandfather's weather. Something's different. I've been doing this a long time, and this is not how I remember it. So there's, and plus, in some cases, really practical things are at stake. So I think you can, you know, in national politics in Washington, the kind of polarization that you get, that can be mitigated in particular places where people have really practical things at stake.
Well, you mentioned your work on Climate Desk. I have been referring to that and also talking about Mother Jones, but you've also worked, your writing has appeared in Slate, Boston Globe, Washington Post. What does Climate Desk do that those other things don't do?
Climate Desk is a media consortium, and what we do is we pool and share content so that more people can get, we hope, really good climate science reporting and climate-related content. So it's basically a partnership between Mother Jones, Slate, The Atlantic, The Guardian, and Huffington Post just joined, and some other publications. And so if I write something for, and it goes to Mother Jones first, if Slate wants it, they can have it. And so sometimes you'll write something and it puffs up all these places.
And then you're the host of Climate Desk Live?
We do a live briefing series, usually in D.C., where we bring people in to talk about the issues, prominent scientists or prominent, you know, communicators.
Now, the EPA and the Obama administration are trying to write a lawsuit-proof regulation that is effective in cutting carbon emissions from America's power plants, which are the largest source of the nation's greenhouse gas pollution. Is there a problem? How can you write something that's lawsuit-proof? If the language in the regulation is too stringent, it's possible it could cause the shutdown of coal plants before there's enough alternative power to replace them, and ultimately lead to higher electric bills, power blackouts, et cetera, et cetera. If it's weak, then it will be ineffective.
I think that, I'm very skeptical that this wouldn't be sued over. We fully expect this to be fought out tooth and nail. I mean, this is the biggest part of the administration's and the most contentious part of the administration's attempt to do something about climate change. It's the part that really has teeth. It's the part that will really change, not just getting people ready, not just adapting, but actually changing what our level of emissions are. And so, yeah, it's going at coal, and coal has a lot of defenders. But, you know, at the same time, the Supreme Court has, you know, made clear that the EPA can move forward in regulating, and that was a long process. And so it looks like the administration has this power. So it'll be fought out in court, but I think the administration expects that they have a good case. It's going to be a slow process because of these battles.
Well, has the troubled rollout and fight over the Affordable Care Act served as an object lesson for the EPA that they have to get these regulations right from the start?
Well, I think that they know that everything they do is going to be watched incredibly closely. So many people watching this.
And we have been hearing about the Obama administration's war on coal. Scientists say that is counterproductive because coal is a major source of the problem. On the other hand, when President Obama was running for office the first time, he talked about wanting to have clean coal. Have we ever come up with clean coal?
I haven't done a lot of reporting on that, but I have done enough to be skeptical. So, I mean, you know, coal is clearly a major, major source of greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, as you transition into this world that we need to be in, where we're using less intensive sources, and you look at all the sources, you look at nuclear, you look at natural gas, obviously you look at renewables, I mean, coal is the one where it looks like there's the least role for it in an energy portfolio of the future.
Even,
I mean, all of them have drawbacks, but do they have drawbacks as big as coal? Because people also, because of burning coal, there are all these particulate air emissions, and that leads to, you know, diseases, respiratory diseases, and even some deaths. So, I mean, there's a lot of downsides.
Well, in the debate over the Keystone XL pipeline, we hear a lot about whether it'll be safe or not, but we hear nothing about the pollution that will result from the use of that actually rather dirty tar sands petroleum.
Yeah, the issue there is really, I mean, from a policy perspective, and this is why it's an odd debate. It's sort of more about, well, if we don't let them build this particular pipeline, isn't the stuff going to get out anyway? And isn't it going to be transported by trains rather than this pipeline? And isn't it going to be burned anyway? And there's not much we can do about it. I mean, clearly, you know, burning tar sands is a very bad idea for the planet overall. But the Keystone Pipeline issue is sort of sunk into this complex position of exactly what the administration is going to do, and that has to be determined based upon whether the stuff is going to get burned anyway. So it's a little bit complex.
Chris Mooney's article, You Might Be Cold Right Now, But Your Planet Isn't, is in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. You can also check him out on his other place, Climate Desk, and Climate Desk Live. How do people access that?
ClimateDesk.org.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Great to talk with you.